So this talk is more about summarizing work that I have done in a lot of years, because it proposes a type of research that I think it's getting more acceptable now. And so I think I need different, and sorry about my dogs if they bark too much. So this is the the standard model of cosmology, and I assume that most of you are familiar with all these epochs. And here I'm just want to give a big picture of my talk. So I hope to show you by them this talk three main aspects, three main catchphrases. So the first is that the universe is divided in three main epochs that I will arbitrarily call early, intermediate, and late. The second and more important is that there are uncertainties in the physical processes that dictate the dynamics of all these epochs. And third, that these uncertainties can all propagate to affect the current expansion of the universe and the current structure formation. And that's important because we use observations of the current expansion and the current structure formation to assess the microphysics of dark energy. So this talk is more a cautionary tale that in order to do that, in order to be successful in understanding late time dark energy, we have to get a more holistic approach in trying to understand the whole history at the same time. So as an introduction, I will just define these phases. Won't spend much time on this because this is more like a technical seminar. So first there is early that starts from inflation, the first phase of accelerated expansion that we have in the universe. We know that is not due to a cosmological constant because inflation ended, but there's also all the interesting aspects of the early universe, radiation, relativistic species were important throughout the early phase, dominant for most of it, but also important throughout the entire phase. The universe was ionized, is one of the two epochs where the universe is ionized. And the early universe, it ended with recombination when the atoms of hydrogen and helium recombined, and it was the emission of the cosmic microwave background. And that's kind of the golden era to be probed via the cosmic microwave background. So the second one that I call intermediate, it's a phase where cold dark matter, non-relativistic species, to be more precise, dominate. And then finally, the expansion of the universe were gentle enough for structures to grow. It's also typical for the typical mass ranges that is allowed by data, the epoch where neutrinos became non-relativistic, and that transition does affect the current expansion and current structure formation. And this phase ended with reionization when the universe became ionized again. But the second time in its history, but now this is due to the photons of like large stars. Now there's not a lot of metals in the ISM, interstellar median during those times. And we know that transition lines for metals, it's very important to cool the gas. So the stars are massive, lots of ionized radiation and the universe actually continues to be ionized up to today. So that's like kind of the golden era to be probed by 2200 centimeters, although I'm not gonna talk about 2200 centimeters today. And finally, we have the late universe, where in the first half, it continues to be dominated by non-relativistic species, but then the universe started its second phase of accelerated expansion. Now it might be due to a cosmological constant, we don't know. There are other interesting aspects of the late universe is where for a lot of important scales, gravitational collapse became highly nonlinear. It's also the peak of star formation and other baryonic effects, and that's important because they obfuscate our ability to use structure formation to probe late-time dark energy. On the other hand, it's an epoch where we have lots of probes, lots of optical probes, which facilitates our job, and that's like kind of the golden era of optical astronomy. So we have all these epochs, with highly different physics. So how do we know and probe each epoch separately? And that's an important question because cosmology is an observational field. It's not like an experiment that we can make that isolate all the variables we don't want. and just focus on the variables and the degrees of freedom we do want. We do receive the light from the universe at once. So how do we know reverse engineering which phase is each? And one of way of doing this is by combining and using like different types of probes and different types of observers, which here I'm dividing in four types of houses of observers. Because I come from the CMB, the good guys are always the CMB, the Gryffindor from Harry Potter. So we have the cosmic microwave background. We have the bad guys, which are the local measurement of Hubble constant and type 1a supernova. We also have gravitational lensing of optical galaxy and counting of nonlinear structures. And you have BAO. And that is what I define the modern school of cosmology. Of course, gravitational waves is coming into the game. 21 centimeters coming to the game, but if I have to make a cut today to fit this Harry Potter analogy, I've divided this four houses of observers. And so what I'm going to do now is the following exercise. I'm going to take like a subset of this data, for example, the CMB and the BAO. I'm going to see what type of standard model these observations do prefer or do allow. And I'm going to check the compatibility against different subset observers, like the Hubble, the local measurement of the Hubble constant and the gravitational lensing of optical galaxies. And doing this exercise is very important to you know, ensure that we have a consistent model of the universe, which is actually the hardest thing to achieve today. So if you do this, we start to get some interesting conclusion that the peace between these house observers is quite fragile. So here on this plot, I'm showing on red, and if you're colorblind, is the dots where the dots are circle, the predictions from the cosmic microwave background and BAO of the Hubble constant throughout the years, and including latest like predictions from 2018, versus on blue or like a star, the dots where the dots are star, of the local measurements of the Hubble constant. And you can see that they don't agree with each other, and the disagreement is getting, it's increasing with time. Of course, we have gravitational waves, which are where the dots are crosses or greens, if you can see colors. And you can see that, you know, it's important to have a third probe, but the error bars are still quite large. So if you truly believe that the standard model of cosmology is the universe that is provided by the CMB and BAO, that the universe that we actually see is a universe that expands way too fast. There's also different type of double quotes tensions that comes from a parameter called S8. S8 is an interesting parameter that merges cosmic expansion and structure formation. So a way to see what S8 means is the following. Consider two universe A and B, whereby, you know, initial conditions, they have the fixed amount of cold dark matter in it. Then in that case, a universe with large S8 is a universe that is more inhomogeneous at its scale of 8 megaparsec. But you can also interpret S8 as the following. So consider again that you have two universe, A and B again, but now you fix the amount of inhomogeneity at 8 megaparsec by initial conditions. Then in that case, a universe that has a larger S8 is a universe that has more cold dark matter in it. And you can see that here, the comparison between the predictions from the cosmic microwave background against actually measurements from gravitational lensing of optical galaxies from different types of servers. And you can see that even though the error bars are large, you know, there's a systematic shift between predictions and surveys. And, you know, once we learn how to combine those surveys, take into account systematic effects, you know, we expect the error bars to decrease and you know, by like a factor of 2, because we have like 4, so assuming they're kind of similar. So this tension is going to increase. So again, the interpretation of this is that if you truly believe that the standard model of cosmology is given by the CMB and BAO, then the universe that we actually see is a universe that expands too fast because of the Hubble constant, and it's either too homogeneous or has too little dark matter. And too homogeneous, of course, at a specific scale. And such results may imply that dark energy is not a cosmological constant. We know that we have previous phases of accelerated expansion, that was not driven, were not driven by the cosmological concept, but this talk is a cautionary tale. It's a cautionary tale that in order to make that conclusion, we have to understand what happens in the different phases of the universe. So to end this introduction and start the first session of questions, I'm just do a brief introduction of two-point correlation function and power spectrum, because I'm gonna do this a lot in my talk. So if you ask yourselves, like, this is how do you extract information from the cosmic microwave background? One way is to actually see the statistics of the anisotropies of the intensity of those photons. So here I'm showing a Planck map of those intensity maps and showing the anisotropies that we actually see in the sky. So the way we actually get information from the CMB is by pointing our radio telescopes in a single direction, measuring the temperature and the polarization on that direction, and then correlating with the temperature anisotropy and the polarization anisotropy that we see in another direction, fixing this angle and making averages over the sky. And if you do this, you can get correlation functions of the intensity of the polarization, which here by for the didactics, I just assume that is one polarization state, but we know that is actually two. And you can actually get a cross correlation between intensity and polarization of this, those photons. So this is how we measure, but we are physicists. And so we like to interpret things on the Fourier, in Fourier space. So this is the Fourier transform of the auto correlation of the intensity of the photons, of the temperature of those photons. And here I just want to emphasize a few structures in this Fourier transform. The first that at low L's or large scales, there's this kind of plateau. And then it's followed by a series of oscillations that have well-defined position and well-defined relative amplitudes. And that, and by observing the position and relative amplitudes, which is actually the two things that we need a lot for characterizing musical instruments, we can actually probe the contents of the universe, like how much dark matter, how much dark energy it is, and so forth. So in the current universe, we do the same. We can do a very similar exercise where now we are trying to correlate the position of overdensities and underdensities of dark matter. So suppose just for didactics that now we have a fictitious dark matter telescope and we can observe clusters and voids. So if we make the similar type of correlation at fixed angle and make average of the sky, we get the correlation functions of the cold dark matter. In reality, we have to use bias traces and that, it, you know, comes with a lot of technical challenges, but for the sake of argument, I just assume that you can observe dark matter directly. And if you see the Fourier transform of this correlation is actually what is the bottom is the matter power spectrum. And from this famous gift from the 1990s from Tegmark, there is a lot of important points. So first, the parameter that I'm varying here quite widely in comparison to today's error bars is a parameter from the physics of inflation, that accelerated expansion that happens in the early universe, like very early universe. So you can see that physics in the early universe can change the structural formation today and the structural formation that we see from the CMB. But there's also another point here that is quite important, is that changes in the CMB and matter power spectrum, they have to be consistent to each other. And that is actually the difficult part in cosmology, you know, making changes that are consistent among different epochs and different observations. So with that, I end the introduction, and people have questions, let me know.
I don't see any hands raised, so yeah, I think it's fine.
Okay, so in the first part, like a real part of the talk, I'm going to talk about some, you know, considerations about the physics of the early universe. So I'm going to start with the physics of inflation. So we know that we have this accelerated expansion, but why do we need inflation? Why do we need this accelerated expansion? Well, I'm just going to give you two problems that inflation solves. I think there are more, but just, you know, just the state of didactics and motivation. So the first one is the problem of the horizon, is the idea that before inflation, it's the horizon of the universe, the photos of the CMB actually, are the order of 2 degrees. So it's hard to explain why the CMB looks like a tropic throughout the whole sky. So that's a problem that inflation solves. It was designed to solve. But there's another one that I actually like it even more, is the idea that inflation produced the seeds of perturbations that grow later on through gravitational collapse into galaxies and planets and us. And it produced seeds with the right type of statistics and right type of properties. So here, for example, I'm just showing you two possible models that were quite popular in the 90s for producing those types of seeds, cosmic string reference inflation. And I just want to show that, for example, cosmic strings and other types of physics that produce these seeds can, for example, predict a CMB that has only one peak instead of like many that we see. So here I just showed WMAP and SPT to show like how many peaks we see today. And it's actually a lot, I think it's order 10. But it also produced these peaks that is pi over 2 out of phase to actually see. And that's the difference between perturbations that I call adiabatics versus isocurvature, is basically sine versus cosine. And the fact that we can actually see multiple peaks, it's a sign that these seeds have coherence in time, something that you don't have with cosmic strings, because it's like a stochastic process. So you see that this is a problem that inflation solves, and I don't think it was designed to solve that problem. So I actually like it a lot. So if you ask like, what is the standard model of inflation? What is the statistics of the seeds, the power spectrum of these initial seeds that inflation produces, is usually a power spectrum. So the oscillations we actually see, it comes from the inflationary initial power spectrum plus physics that happens, you know, from inflation to recombination. And here I'm just showing like what a power law looks like. And a power law has an amplitude and a tilt, and these are two of the 6 preparameters of the CMB. But what I would like to say is the following, that this is the standard model, but inflation can actually be more complicated than that. So this is something that I work my PhD. And now you have models of inflation where you have a scalar field that has a tilt, that has that gets accelerated by a kick in the potential. There are other ways to do that. And I just want to show that, you know, phenomenology of inflation, a successful model of inflation can have different amplitudes in large versus small scales. It can have oscillations, damping. And, you know, I can have like a whole talk about this. So if inflation can be different, and we know that we are not very sure of the microphysics of inflation, you can actually ask the question like, what do we know better? Do we know better the physics of inflation, the physics of the inflation? And if you think it's the latter, then you can try to use model independent techniques to try to reconstruct what the data actually prefers to this initial power spectrum. And when actually you do this, it's realized that the data actually like this type of imbalance of power between large and small scales. And again, I could give a whole talk about this, but the question I want to ask is the following. If inflation can be complicated, now if there are uncertainties in the phenomenology of inflation, how can it be disconnected to uncertainties in our inferences about the late universe? So, to answer this question, you have to realize how the CMB actually make predictions for the Hubble constant. And it does this by measuring not only the position of these peaks, but also the relative amplitude of those oscillations with respect to the plateau at large scales. And inflation can shift this large to small balance of power. It's a small effect, but when you realize like, we actually put like a model inflation that is preferred, it actually shifts the Hubble constant slightly down to even lower values. And the Hubble constant, you know, is already like at 4.5 sigma tension. So this is just show proof of principle that the situation can be actually even worse than we think. So that's one example. What are the ways that early universe can be connected to uncertainties on our inferences about the late universe? So one thing that the prediction of the CMB actually relies on is the calibration of the sound horizon, which is the calibration of the actually physical distance that corresponds to the 2-degree angular horizon that we see in the sky. We think that the universe is quite simple at redshifts above recombination, but what if it is not true? Like, what if we are missing some physics? And there's actually an interesting fact that motivated this for a long time, something that has been in my mind for a long time that it makes hard to understand, which is whenever you see some chains or some data, you see that if you put some model of dark energy, it's not that hard, you know, to explain the CMB. So you have like big contours, a lot of parameter space is allowed. But then as soon as you combine CMB with DBAO, usually the parameter space, the allowed parameter space shrinks enormously for all these models of exotic dark energy. And why is the case? It's the case because there's some kind of a coincidence that, you know, the CMB and BAO are predicting the wrong double quotes, the wrong value of the Hubble constant, but they agree with each other. And that's actually quite hard. Yeah. Of course, you know, if you have the correct model, they should all agree with each other. But if you think about it, if you have the wrong cosmology, then CMB should not agree with local. BAO should not agree with local. But because they depend on the distance to very different redshifts, CMB should not agree with BAO. If you think that the missing puzzle is some kind of dark energy or dark matter, co-dark matter after recombination, because the weights of these integrals that are the integrals that calculate the distance to the BAO and the distance to CMB, they have very different relative importance of dark energy, dark matter. So it's kind of a coincidence, kind of a magic that they both disagree with local measurements, but they do agree with each other. And that could, you know, tell you that maybe the problem is the sound horizon, because if the sound horizon changed, then if the problem is in the sound horizon, then almost automatically they should agree with each other and disagree together with the local measurements. So for example, one possibility is like, what if there's some kind of dark energy in the early universe? What if we're missing some physics? The first question you can ask, like, can we falsify that hypothesis? And this is kind of, we kind of can, because the CMB has two different scales, which is the scales of the position of the peaks and the scale of the damping of those peaks. And they come from very different physics, from very different redshifts. And you can use that to constrain those models. People have proposed models that, you know, wearing these models, dark energy can have up to 10% of the total energy density. These models can raise the Hubble constant to 71 kilometers per second per megaparsec. That is kind of in the middle between what we have now and local measurements. These models do predict interesting phenomenology for the damping tail of polarization that will be able to observe the Simons Observatory. But at the same time, these models do predict tensions in these other SA parameters that is even higher than predicted today. So the tensions between, you know, weak CMB and weak Lensing can actually be worse than we think. So there are multiple ways to see this, and people have trying like all types of models that are still compatible with the CMB. One possible idea is that there is no single smoking gun to explain all these tensions, that maybe the Lambda CDM is breaking at multiple redshifts. And that's not that crazy, because why the dark energy is the cosmological constant anyway? Like, sometimes people shift, like, say, oh, all the blame is the cosmological constant. And then they shift all their attentions to the early universe and just assume that the cosmological constant is the dark energy, and we are all happy about it. We don't forget that there are uncertainties and there are interesting questions at multiple redshifts. And if the Lambda CDM breaks at multiple redshifts, then how can we reverse engineering to understand these different types of physics? And that is actually a quite hard problem. There are other ways that you can change the sound horizon. You can put more relativistic species of neutrinos that have thermal equilibrium that changes directly the Hubble expansion before recombination, and those affect the Hubble constant prediction. The CMB actually doesn't like that too much. And there's actually a very beautiful physics why. So here I'm just showing things that I've worked on the DSY1 on how to get better constraints. So you can see that we don't like to have more than delta NFX of more than 0.3, 0.4, which can fractional NFX can be achieved by not have no perfectly thermal equilibrium. But there's actually a very interesting physics why the CMB doesn't like neutrinos. And it comes from the fact that neutrinos has a sound speed equals the speed of light, while photons, they have mass, double quote. They have mass because they are tied together to baryons using through Compton scattering. So they have an effective mass. So if you observe how overdensities of neutrinos propagate versus overdensities of photons, you quickly realize that neutrinos go like in front of photons. So here I'm showing these arrows. But because neutrinos are relativistic, and because relativistic particles do contribute significantly to the gravitational potentials at that time, that produces a shift into the photons due to gravitational forces that changes the position and the relative amplitude of these peaks in a way that the CMB actually doesn't like. So you can see that the way to fix those problems is by introducing self-interaction in neutrinos or interactions that will reduce the sound speed of neutrinos. And people have done that. People are working on this. And it's actually one of the proposals to change the early universe. So you can see that there are multiple ways that the early universe can produce shifts that we might associate to new microphysics of dark energy. And for that, I end another section and I'm open to questions.
So again, I don't see any raised hands.
Okay, so now the second part is quite small, that part. Just think about a little bit of the intermediate universe. So you can start about reionization. So we have this epoch of reionization, like the universe becomes ionized again. So you can think on how this affects the CMB. So from like E&M point of view, basically you think about putting a thin sheet of electrons between and you and the CMB, and the sheet of electrons will have a horizon and they will rescatter some of the photons, and that will affect the polarization, the temperature. And in the standard model of reionization, you believe that pop 2 stars are the main contributors for ionized radiation, and that actually implies that reionization happens very fast. The transition between a universe that is in totally neutral to totally ionized happens quite fast in redshift. But there are other possible sources of reionized radiation. So the Planck 2015, there's an update from 2018 that I can talk later. We try to use, given that reionization can be more complicated than usual, we try to use the data to reconstruct what the data will actually prefer on the history of the opaqueness of the universe, like how, reionization have to happen that fast, or can we have like pop 3 stars or like dark matter annihilation, the sources that make this progression of the opaqueness, this increase of opaqueness to be slowly. And when in the Planck 2015, the significance reduced a lot in 2018, but it's still a little bit there. We show that there are room for like more exotic models of reionization. And again, I could give a whole talk about this. I actually have given a whole talk about reionization in the past, but the question I want to ask is, okay, if reionization is more complicated, how these uncertainties in reionization are connected to uncertainties in the early universe. And then we did these studies and we actually realized that the step predicted by the data on the primary order power spectrum, the significances and the amplitude of that step do depend on the hypothesis of reionization. And we know that that step actually propagates into uncertainties and shifts in the Hubble constant. So you can see, like, you start to see the main topic of this talk, where like these uncertainties can all propagate in very high nonlinear ways and obfuscate various inferences about specific epochs of the universe. So in cosmology, either you make sure that the whole history is correct, or you can have these things popping everywhere, this kind of obfuscations popping everywhere. So what are more ways the intermediate universe is connected to the late time universe? So one, this is a paper, very interesting paper from a European group that actually spooked me at the time, where if you don't consider BAO, but you just consider the CMB, And you assume a model where dark energy decays into radiation, a small fraction of it, like between 5 and 10%. Basically, you have cold dark matter W equals zero converting to W equals a third radiation, which is the opposite of what neutrino does. Now, when the neutrinos become non-relativistic, that is triple quotes, like radiation converting into non-relativistic species. Here's the opposite. And you can see that at least if you just consider the CMBE, this can affect prediction of the CMBE to the Hubble constant and structure formation that actually can align better with data. So there's a lot of stuff between the CMBE and the late universe that can affect, you know, the current expansion, the current structure formation. And as I hint you, neutrinos is actually the opposite of this effect. It's basically double quotes, triple quotes, radiation converting to non-relativistic species, or decaying to non-relativistic species, cold dark matter. And therefore, actually neutrinos predicts even lower values of the Hubble constant. And actually these changes in the universe expansion is actually what probes neutrinos the best today. So given that, we ask the following question. We try to create very bizarre models, very general models of dark energy that are important between redshift 1 and 2, where you don't have that many type 1a supernovas to probe the equation of state, and where probing the equation of state is actually harder because dark energy is not that dominant. And we can say, like, can we have models that undo the expansion changes that are produced by neutrinos and they're not allowed by the data? And the answer is yes. And that's quite important because once neutrinos, the predictions of neutrinos for the cosmic expansion is fixed, you actually got a boost in the probability of having like large neutrino mass, because the S8 tension actually can be partially solved by having massive neutrinos. So, and again, but this can also be written the other way around. If you want to understand dark energy from redshift like 2 to 0, neutrinos, the uncertainties in the neutrino mass can actually obfuscate your ability to reconstruct the dark energy equation state. There's also another point here that I'm going to just point later, is that, you know, people ask a lot of these questions, at least used to ask in the past, when, for example, studying WFIRST and studying future survey, is why do we need supernovas at high redshift? No, because in Lambda SDM, if you truly believe that the standard model is correct, then most of the statistical weights comes from supernovas at redshift between 0 and 1, not 1 and 2. And this is one of the type of questions that you can only answer, you can only, you know, falsify, type of hypothesis that you can only falsify if you have lots of supernovas in redshift 1 and 2, even if that reduces your statistic power on redshift between 0 and 1. So, and people have asked the same type of BAO, like, why do we need BAO at redshift 2 and redshift 1.5? Well, to do the same type of questions, you know. So sometimes the questions you want to answer have a direct impact in the way you build your experiments and the way you build your surveys. So we have to be aware of that. So with that, I end the intermediate epoch, and that's also open to questions.
So I can ask, I mean, like, so on the previous slide, so I didn't maybe quite understand, like, I mean, what you meant here. So so you mentioned this possible, I guess, like degeneracy between like neutrino effects and the dark energy behavior over time, mm-hmm. you know, but, you know, but that degeneracy will depend on which observable, like, you're looking at, right? I mean, so for example, right, you know, so neutrinos will have a scale dependent effect, whereas dark energy perturbations, you know, should, you know, be almost scale independent on scales below the dark energy sound horizon, right?
Absolutely. And that's for the structure formation. Here I'm talking about the degeneracy on the cosmic expansion. And why do they focus on the cosmic expansions? Because we know structure formation really likes neutrino masses, really likes a neutrino mass of 0.3 to 0.4 eV. You know, and the reason why, when you combine everything, like all the data, and you have like 0.15 or 0.11, even some papers, that's because of the facts of neutrinos on the cosmic expansion. So if you can fix that by have some weird dark energy, then you can boost. And because neutrinos are preferable in structure formation, then you can actually shift, you know, our expectation widely. So, but for the, you know, but the degeneracy here, I focus on the degeneracy on the cosmic expansion, on, you know, distances.
Okay, sure. I see. Okay, thanks.
More questions? Okay, so last part, late universe. So, you know, we have a second epoch of accelerated expansion. Yay! No, we know that. And one of the ways is by observing type 1a supernova, which are not standard candles. And that means that you cannot observe the absolute luminosity of type 1a supernova. That's not possible. What you can do is it standardize the relative luminosity between different supernovas. And that's critical, because that's why supernovas cannot probe the Hubble constant without extra observations. And that's why you also need a low Z sample that are very well, you know, determined. That's why low Z sample of supernova, systematic and low Z sample, can actually affect your W estimation. Because what you're doing here is comparing the luminosity of high Z supernova versus low Z supernovas, and seeing how then the distances evolves with time. And we do a quite good job now. And just do the exercise of having a universe with a CDM only, you will see that the supernovas at redshift 2.1 is around half a magnitude too faint. And we believe that, you know, we have error bars of like 10 times smaller than that. So I think it's pretty, you know, it's pretty standard that, you know, they prove acceleration. But as I said, it's actually, they cannot measure the Hubble constant without external probe. And usually these external, like Cepheids and masers, they have, they assume no covariance between supernovas and these additional observations, but there's actually a covariance between them, because some systematics are similar, especially for Cepheids. And so for the first time here, we actually consider like the full self-sufficient, you know, a full covariance between Lissens ladders and type 1a supernova. And if you do that and try to make a lot of like type of bizarre dark energy models, you see that they all have a very hard time decreasing H naught, because they have to change the distance as a function of redshift on redshifts where supernova actually you know, have interesting, like tiny error bars. So it's, you know, unless you make those changes at very low redshift. And here, like we tried to make changes, abrupt changes at redshift like 0.02, and even that was kind of hard, you know. So unless you go quite wild on what happened in the very, very local universe, it's kind of a hard to make dark energy to, you know, predict different values of the Hubble constant. And another thing that's interesting on the spot on the right, you can see like the scale of the y-axis, like 0.05, 0.10, 0.15 magnitudes. This is like what we have today. But on the next decade, actually on this decade with W first, we will actually have much error bars, much smaller error bars. So you can see here, like what is the Y scale, which is like way below 0.1. And you can see that there is like different proposed strategies on W first. One that only goes to supernovas of 0.5 and has better error bars and low Z. Use here not so, because here there's also a difference between having and not having a spectra. But the other one is going to very like forget about spectra, do all automatic supernovas, confirmed supernovas, and go to very high redshift that will take a lot of observational time. And again, if you like one proposed strategy or the other, it depends not only on your ability to probe systematic, but on the type of questions you want to answer. And I actually believe that are interesting questions we can answer that motivates us to try to get the expansion rate from 0 to 3 on 0 to 2 instead of just 0 to 1. So, and you can see here that like that one question that the supernova can answer alone is the cosmic expansion compatible with lambda CDM? And that's a question that supernova can answer alone. Like, is it compatible or it's not compatible? But suppose it's not compatible. Suppose now we do discover that W is not equal to -1. Then your next question is, okay, so what are the physical properties of dark energy? I just don't want you to just know if W is equal to -1/3, -1/2, or -0.9. Actually, if it's -1/3, it's interesting because that would be curvature, but no, anything below that. I want physical hypotheses that, you know, I can talk to a particle physicist and he will say, oh, good, I needed that information. So to do that, supernova is not enough. You need to combine supernova with structure formation. And to do that, you have to have a lot of different data. So here's the kind of data that I'm interested in. Most of the servers, you know, Bingo is a BAO server in 21 centimeters that has been doing Brazil and England. Core is even is proposed, but it's just like the type of combinations that you have to have in order to ask this type of questions, more general questions. So just giving a, so how do we probe? There are multiple ways to probe structure formation, but here I'm just gonna focus on gravitational lensing of optical galaxies. It comes from the fact that if you assume that optical galaxies far away are perfect circular, we don't have to assume that, but that's for didactics, then we know that light is bent by structure formation, and therefore the galaxy that we actually observe will be ellipsoidals, and the statistics of these ellipses, the shapes, can actually give us information about the structure formation. So let me give you a concrete example that I revisit that was popular in the last decade that I revisit recently, that suppose you can create all models of inflation of dark energy that are compatible with the 4 physical assumptions. One is that GR is correct. Second one, there is no direct coupling between dark matter and dark energy besides the minimal coupling from the universal nature of gravity. Same for the standard model, there is no, you know, direct time diagram between standard model particles and dark energy besides the universal nature of gravity. And then dark energy doesn't collapse on scale much smaller than the horizon. We know by GR that if dark energy, it's not a cosmological constant, it has to cluster on scales around the horizon. That's just, you know, there's no enough gauge freedom to make a statement that dark energy doesn't collapse in all gauges. It's not a gauge independent a sentence. But I'm talking here now in scales much smaller than the horizon, like galaxies or clusters of dark energy. So what are all the types of models that you can create with these 4 physical assumptions? And here is an example of a paper published from Dragon and Wayne in 2009, where I showed that it is the standard model in the CDM, and then you can put, for example, curvature on flat slicings. You can also go this from scalar fields, the quintessence, and it can also include not only curvature on spatial slicings, but also early dark energy and early, yeah, you can be both in the intermediate and the early phases of dark energy. You can also have smoothish basic non-canonical fields that can have phantom equation of states, and it can also put like early or curvature. So how can we falsify the paradigm? How can we falsify the hypothesis instead of just falsify specific models? And this comes from the fact that if these hypotheses are true, then there is a very interesting consistency between between expansion rate and structure formation. So here I'm just showing an example. So here I'm showing the formula for the Fourier transform of the cold dark matter correlation function, the matter power spectrum. You know that there's a lot of components here. Some comes from inflation, that's how early physics can affect structure formation. Other comes from both early and intermediate universe. But there's this scale-independent shift, scale-independent amplitude that is called the growth factor. And interesting that if those hypotheses are true, then this growth factor is the only part of the matter power spectrum that is kind of like directly changed by dark energy. And that growth factor is a function of the expansion rate. So if you know Hubble and the derivatives of the Hubble function, you know the growth factor. There is no additional free parameters. So there's a consistency between type 1a supernova and gravitational lensing that you can exploit with W force, for example, to make predictions, statements like this. If the background is compatible with lambda CDM, but the growth factor is 10% off, then this paradigm is falsified. That's the type of statements that you can make. And we actually studied that recently, and we showed that, you know, actually we showed that using principal components that, you know, if the background is compatible with the lambda CDM, but the growth factor deviates by more than 5%, then the upper half of these compatibility models are falsified. So the only way to save those hypotheses is by including only dark energy. We don't know if it's saved. We just know that that's the only logical possibility. So this can actually, you know, be very interesting for particle physics. So suppose we do falsify those hypotheses. So what can explain then this new relationship between structure formation and cosmic expansion? So there are different ways to break that hypothesis. For example, you can change how gravity works. So here's just DES data that I participated in trying to probe phenomenological changes of the Poisson equation and the Lensing equation on linear scales. So far, you know, we're all compatible with GR, but that's one type of possibility. And that's, you know, actually to probe both of them, this is, you know, one axis requires spectra. So things like DESI, the other one can be done by LSST. So that's one more justification why do we need these different types of surveys. Another possibility is if you have a direct coupling between dark energy here being modeled by scalar field and cold dark matter, and we are actually trying to probe them now with like the DS data and LSST data. So, and here there's a coupling with the C, and we think that DS and LSST will be able to probe this coupling by just a few percent. So that's another logical possibility. So give me some, just a few examples. So, you know, still have a few minutes. So just talk about a little bit about some additional work that have been done. I've been conducting in surveys. So another way that you can kind of test, at least in lambda CDM, if that test breaks, it's harder to interpret, but one way that you can test that paradigm, at least in lambda CDM, you can test that paradigm. It's a little bit more restrictive, but it's easier to understand didactically, is by kind of duplicating the lambda CDM parameters such that you have some kind of cold dark matter that only affects the growth factor, some type of dark energy equation of state that only affects the growth factor, that is somehow disentangled from the cold dark matter parameter that do affect geometry, and the dark energy equation of state that do affect geometry. And if you make that split, you know, you can see that if you change the dark matter growth here, you can see that at least on linear scales, it's a scale independent amplitude, versus if you change the geometry, that changes a bunch of things like matter radiation equality. So you have a much more complex shape. It's actually, this paper just passed internal reviews, was actually just published. So we published these results. You see that it's still compatible, but we get an interesting error bars. I think the error bars we're going to decrease a lot. If that test fails, we're still investigating. Like, if that test fails, we don't know if that means that the paradigm fails, or we just have different models. So one thing that we're going to do in the future is populate this geometry growth with theoretical points that from models that are within that simple paradigm versus models that are outside that simple paradigm. So that is the more precise statement, but this is still a work in progress. At least we wanted to have like a DES constraint on that split. Another thing that you have to be doing is, and that's problematic for all this observation, is the effect of baryons. So baryons, if you don't take into account, it can create biases. So here, the blue, the Gaussian illustrious, that is not very good call independent plot shows a lot of biases in our contours with respect to the true simulated model because of the presence of baryonic effect and mitigating such effects is important, even if that gives you larger variance. Now, there's always a trade-off between biases and variance. Last, we are also trying to study how you can have synergies between LSST, which will have a large area, and W4s, which will have a greater depth. And I think that that complementarity can also be used to ask more general questions, even though right now we are still only studying that synergy on the more vanilla extensions to Lambda CDM. But I think that the depth versus the area actually changes the type of questions you can answer. And we only have 5 minutes. I think I'm gonna skip this. Only if I have time, I can come back. But I would like to say thank you, and I'll put you questions, and I hope to show you this, like, this kind of a new program where you try to, you know, falsify the standard model of cosmology by not just observing the late time structure and late time geometry, by trying to make this third axis where, you know, at the same time you do this, you have to create a consistency and make sure that there's consistency in all epochs of the universe. And because cosmology, you know, is an observational field, we are required to have this kind of holistic approach, even if most of our research lies into one specific epoch. And even if you just care about inflation or you just care about dark energy, you have to have at least a coherent, holistic, you know, view that of like other physics in the universe that can obfuscate your ability to probe the microphysics of what you are interested in. And thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks, Vivian. Here's, let's all applaud virtually or audibly. Okay, so we have a little time for questions. You know, maybe I can start. So can you go back to that slide where you were, I guess, you know, comparing, like, you know, the growth versus geometrical probes?
Yeah.
Yeah. Here. Yeah. 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 This one. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. You know, like, is there some easy way to understand, you know, why the growth probe is so much weaker than the other probes? You know, I would have naively thought, I guess, you know, that this omega growth is measured, you know, like comparably well as like sigma eight is measured. No.
So first, there's a question of why the posteriors collapse are so nonlinear now. They're both posteriors are very big, and then when you combine, it becomes very small here, you know, both blue. And that's really because you need, like, the power spectrum is like a triangle, and you need, like, both arms to be able to probe that very well. But even if you can probe that both sides arms of the power spectrum, growth, because growth is a scale independent, it's a little bit, it's kind of degenerative bias. It's not completely degenerative bias because the 3x2 has different, if you're just doing like galaxy lensing, it would be completely degenerative bias because bias always do this scale independent shift into the lensing. Well, because you're combining clustering and galaxy lensing and cosmic shear, you actually have some way to, differentiate bias from omega growth. But that is, I think that's the main problem. There's a big degeneracy between your ability to probe omega growth and your ability to probe bias.
Like, so this was not using like lensing?
No, this was using lensing. No, this was DS lensing. But no, with the current power of DAS-Y1, there was still a lot of, because the green was just external geometry. So there's no bias here. And this is degenerate with, there are other things that can change. AES, for example. And the blue has that's why one, but then the prices are so large. It's when you combine them that makes the omega growth. First, the omega geometry has a very large impact. You can see here, they are changing by the same amount. And you can see that the changes in the power spectrum from omega geometry are way larger for the same type of deltas. And it is scale dependent, which makes it easier to see. It looks like almost like a tilt, while the omega growth is way less. So you can see that by changing 20%, you're almost not changing the power spectrum. And because it looks like scale dependent, independent, that also have the additional correlation with bias where the omega geometry doesn't, because omega geometry looks like a tilt. And tilt is very well proved by the CND.
Okay, I see. All right, thank you. Any further questions?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
So there have been publications claiming that that we see large dense voids that are surrounded by strings of matter. So if we sit inside such a void, say 3 megaparsecs or 500 megaparsecs in size, how would this, wouldn't this affect expansion of the universe and the value of H naught?
Oh, John, like, were you asking about like large voids and if those large voids would pose a problem for the standard model? Was that the question?
If we sit inside such a large void.
If we sit inside a large
inside
void.
Inside a large
void. Okay.
That's it can and let me ask. So there are two parameters you can change in a void: is how large is the void, and I think the void can either the void has the size of the universe, so we are just in a void, and that doesn't solve our problems. What would solve our problems, double quote, is a void that, you know, it's kind of local, and then, you know, most of the universe is outside that void, and somehow, you know, when things come into our void, it changes the value of the Hubble constant. But that we can actually probe with supernovas and you know, because that would create a change in the distance, between very low and like a middle range redshifts that we would be able to observe, and we don't observe with type 1a supernovas. And so I cannot claim that it's completely falsified, because I don't remember, and I don't want to make an imprecise statement, but it's become harder and harder. And with W4 supernova, that would be so precise, you know, it will become even harder. Of course, you can make the voids very local, so local that you don't even have enough volume to observe a lot of types of supernova. And I think that this is still possible. And I don't know what are the updates on that hypothesis of very, very local voids. I know Adam Rees has some papers using supernovas to see if the supernovas crosses the edge of the void, then I think we'll be able to observe. But that hasn't, if it's below and the sample of low Z supernovas that we are getting, it's increasing with time, you know, because getting better with time. So it's a parameter space that we will never be able to shrink completely. But I think we are shrinking the low parameter spaces of cosmic voids, significantly, and we will decrease even more in the next decade. So that's my answer.
I see.
There is another tension. The measurement of lithium 7 locally does not agree with, by looking at stars, doesn't agree with the measurement of lithium 7 that you can synthesize by many orders, many signals.
Yeah, that is an interesting one, and I don't know how to solve that one. That is, suppose it can be this, or suppose, you know, nucleosynthesis is incorrect, if nucleosynthesis is incorrect, it changes our price on omega b squared, and then that can propagate to a lot of observers, when a lot of CMB predictions on current observers. So that is, this really is actually an interesting way of other problems that that we have in the standard model that when corrected will change, will propagate to a lot of inferences we have right now. So it's an actually a great example of this, like a kind of holistic approach that you have to have that, you know, so assuming that the literal problem comes from the BBN that has a lot of propagation, if it comes from local voids, maybe it's not. And maybe that is one way to falsify voids versus BBN changes. So that's something that can be exploited, like how BBN changes propagate to other types of inferences.
It seems difficult to do anything with BBNs. It's one of the best experiments we have in cosmology.
Yes.
Go ahead.
No, but also it assumes that we know the expansion rate there. You know, if you are allowed to have dark nets at redshift 3000, why you're not allowed to have something different in the expansion rate at that those redshifts? You know? That, you know, because we assume there's just radiation there, but, you know, we don't know.
I think the lithium and H-naught are both connected, and it's my question.
That can also be true. Yeah, that's an interesting hypothesis. Okay, yeah. I should read more about the literature on this topic.
Emil, do you have a question?
Yeah. Yes, thank you. So nice talk, first of all. I wanted to understand a little better, you went kind of fast on the W first power to distinguish or even falsify the idea of uniform dark energy. Could you just go back to that slide, please? I just want to understand what you were trying to say there. It went too fast for me. Yeah, I guess okay, it's the next one, I guess, where you have this, yeah. What is this plot showing? That's what I want to understand.
So here it shows the following. So if you combine here we combine synthetic W for supernovas with CMB to probe the dark energy equation of states, of very general dark energy equation of states. So here we allow almost any arbitrary dark energy equation of states between minus 2.5 and 1. And we also allow curvature to be non-zero. So the blue shades are curvature to be zero, and the grays are curvature non-zero. And the dots shows what would be, and for the synthetic W first data, we assume lambdas at the end, okay? So the dash on this plot show what would be the mean distribution of allowed growth factors once the parameters of extensions from the CDM are probed by W for supernova plus CMB. So, okay. You know, so you.
So it's combining all that data, not just W first, right? Yeah.
Yes, it's W first plus CMB, but I'm not combining with weak cleansing because I'm making predictions for weak cleansing. But there's no weak cleansing here, it's just CMB. There's CMB lensing, okay, to be fair, but there's no weak cleansing here because I want to make predictions for the allow range for the growth factor for W first weak cleansing.
Okay, and the result are those dashed lines, you say, in the middle.
The dashed lines, so it was hard to make this so the dashed lines are the means, and the shades are all centered at zero for purpose because the shades and the solid lines tell what is the width. So the true distribution should be centered on the dashed lines with the widths of the shades or the widths of the solid lines, but the plot became too weird to that. So basically, you can interpret to be error bars are of around 5% with a mean that can deviate from lambda's DM up to like a percent.
This is just playing with the W of the dark energy component, but leaving everything else fixed, leaving dark matter, and
leaving the physics. Yeah, well, the parameters are still floating, but not assuming extensions models for dark matter, not assuming extension models for. But the parameters of the cold dark matter can still be float. Joint MCMC.
Okay, and this is in your paper, so I should probably read your paper. Is that right? The paper you've put up there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Right. Yeah. It has my not my preferred name. It has Vinicius Miranda, but it's me. It's just me before my transition.
Okay. Thank you.
Change changing gender in the middle of our academic past this blah blah, but that's okay.
Okay, so in the interest of time, maybe we should stop here and thank Vivian once again.